Hello, baby.
The Cocktail Nation.
Anatomy of a Lounge Lothario.
Hey, baby.
I got a lot of money.
Howard, please. This is beneath
you. No, this is exactly me.
Casanova. You are evil, Demeter.
What you call me? It's not true.
Is it joke, my dove?
Why do you men so treasure this joking so?
Do you love me?
What can I say when you ask? You shouldn't ask, you know. I'll tell you when I feel like it.
Would you like me to give you something to make you sleep?
Now, there's a good idea.
All right, then. Come with me.
Welcome to another look at the Bon Vivants, playboys, and those who lived a jet-setter lifestyle, the Tango Pirates. Just what makes these men who they are? King Farouk is a man that we're looking at this time. Farouk took the Egyptian throne in 1936, just 16 years of age. And at first he was very popular, but his playboy lifestyle soon started to grate on Egyptians, particularly during the hardships of World War II. A British High Commissioner of the era described Farouk as an uneducated, lazy, untruthful, capricious, irresponsible and vain, though with a quick, superficial intelligence and a charm of manner. But his unpopularity contributed to the 1952 revolution that established a republic and eventually installed Nasser as leader. July 52, Farouk had survived 15 years as the undisputed king of Egypt. With the untimely death of his father, King Ahmed Fuad, the 17-year-old heir was forced to take up the reins of a country he had absolutely no idea how to rule. Up until then, he'd been living in the harem with his mother and sisters, and only 6 months prior to his father's death, he was sent off to attend school in London. Farouk had never participated in government and was hardly ever seen at official functions by his father's side. To his misfortune, as soon as he ascended to the throne as boy king, the drums of war began to sound throughout Europe and Africa, with Mussolini well entrenched in Ethiopia and Rommel's war machine racing across North Africa towards the Suez Canal. Great Britain had to maintain absolute control over Egypt and Sudan. Lamson, Britain's former High Commissioner to Egypt and Sudan, was given the task of keeping an eye on the new king. From the very beginning, Lamson was like a pin in Farouk's side. With the threat of war coming knocking at Egypt's door, the pin had become a thorn. Lamson's first worry was the amount of Italian advisers the king had on his payroll. Then there was the pressure of Germany supporters amongst the Egyptian people who saw Berlin as a liberator from British colonial rule. In 1942, when Farouk dissolved Hussein's Syri's government and appointed a new prime minister sympathetic to the Axis powers, a livid Lamson set British troops to surround the Aberdeen Palace. In 1942, when Farouk dissolved Hussein Syri's government and appointed a new prime minister sympathetic to the Axis powers, a livid Lamson sent British troops to surround Aberdeen Palace. In the end, Farouk backed down and appointed the pro-British Mustafa el-Nouris Pasha as the prime minister, and Britain kept Farouk on the throne. When the war ended, Lamson was transferred to the Far East, and Farouk looked like he had everything under control. After the creation of the Arab League in Cairo in 1945, Farouk became the de facto leader of the Arab world, and hence it was only fitting for him to lead the fight against the newly created Jewish state in 1948. The Egyptians thought they had it made. They had a large army in the region, no fighting experience, however, and it shared a border with Palestine. But in no time, Egypt suffered a humiliating defeat against what many considered a bit of a ragtag Israeli army. Using unconventional guerrilla warfare tactics for Farouk, the Arab defeat would mean a bit of a turning point and the beginning to the end of his rule. To understand the king's demise, one must not only look at the political events that happened and shaped Egypt up until 1948, but also how Farouk portrayed himself. His father's most conspicuous disadvantage during his 20-year rule was that he actually didn't speak Arabic, which is kind of strange when you think about it. All official business was conducted in Italian, but he made sure that this wouldn't happen to his only son. From an early age, Farouk took private Arabic lessons. Because he couldn't communicate with the commoner, Fuad made it a point to be seen by his countrymen. And with the advent of the portable camera, Fuad was able to capture an image to match his title. He had all his journeys captured on film, documented and printed in newspapers to show that he was in touch with his subjects. After Fuad's death, the young heir was also able to use the camera to his advantage as well. On his first journey throughout the country, he had an army of photographers in tow, documenting every move. In 1938, Farouk's postcard wedding with the young beauty, Safinaz Zulfikar, was more than just a photo opportunity. It was an opportunity for the masses to fall in love with this new royal couple. After 10 years of marriage, which produced three daughters, the couple divorced. It was no secret the two of them had fallen out of love years before, but the fact that there wasn't a male heir really weighed heavily on their relationship. In the later part of the marriage, Farouk was frequently seen womanizing at the hottest nightclubs in Cairo and Alexandria. In Egypt, the king's gallivanting was put under wraps by the palace censorship office. But when he was abroad, pictures of the fat, balding king surrounded by Europe's social elite were splashed right across the world's tabloid papers. With no wife, no heir, and a humiliating defeat to Israel under his belt, Farouk seemed to be spiraling out of control. Until he met a voluptuous 16-year-old commoner, Nariman Sadek. Once it was announced that the couple was going to marry, Nariman was sent off to Italy to learn proper etiquette on how to become a queen. When the engagement was announced, the Prime Minister went on national radio and paid tribute to the king for selecting his wife from the ranks of the common people. How noble. Shortly after they were married, Nariman gave birth to a son who was named Ahmed Fuad II. From the outside, the king's worries seemed to be over, but unfortunately for him, the honeymoon was short-lived. From the onset, Farouk refused to relinquish his bachelor ways, and soon his follies started to get noticed. The more he surrounded himself with foreigners, the less the palace protocol seemed to matter. Since the cameras were no longer exclusively in the hands of the palace photographers anymore, compromising images of the Playboy King found their way to the streets. While pictures showing the 250-pound Farouk in a bathing suit lying next to his teenage wife in an equally revealing suit were nothing shocking for Europe's elite, they did nothing to help the king's tarnished image at home. Whispers of his scandalous lifestyle started to filter into the army, which still felt cheated for the loss that it sustained in 1948. Though there were many indicators that the end was near, Farouk did little to quell or appease the forces conspiring against him. Elements in the military had been working behind his back for some time, but instead of confronting them in July of 52, he ran off to Alexandria with his young family to escape the heat. All things considered, Farouk was actually lucky to get away with his life. Previously, the British had been there to keep the house of Muhammad all in order, but this time they chose to stay on the sidelines and watch. In the last-ditch effort, the king turned to the Americans, whose influence was growing in the region, and he was convinced the new superpower, fearful of a communist takeover, would intervene on his behalf. To the monarch's surprise, it was actually the Americans who gave the final go-ahead for the coup to take place, and thus he was relegated to Europe for the rest of his life. Farouk was actually a man who moved in circles, particularly through the 50s and 60s, with some of the major jet setters of the Riviera. Once again, another example of a lounge Lothario, I suppose, who probably shouldn't have been in charge, really had no desire, certainly didn't have a desire to be married, that's for sure, probably should have stayed single. I guess the thing with Farouk is that he does actually lack one of the key things that most lounge Lotharios have, and that is charm and charisma. Probably doesn't tick the boxes as far as an adventurous lifestyle goes. But for all intents and purposes, certainly within the lounge Lothario status, particularly with some of his friends, his jet-setting friends who hung around the Riviera. One book that I can recommend is called Too Rich, The High Life and Tragic Death of King Farouk by William Estedium. It's an interesting book. Estedium argues two main points. First, that Farouk was not always the decadent, bloated creature whom the free officers overthrew in 52. But quite the contrary, up until about 1942, he was a handsome and much-loved figure with a genuine, far-reaching, unprecedented appeal amongst the ordinary Egyptians. Indeed, Stadium actually holds that the brief life of extremes made the king one of the most curious and interesting people of the 20th century. Also, Farouk had a significance that went far beyond his playboy reputation. Going along with the British would have made his life easier, ensuring him a long reign, but Farouk actually chose to go along and go alone, thereby unleashing the furies that led to his downfall. Of particular importance was his defiance of Lamson, who he mentioned earlier, so you might like to check that book out, Too Rich, The High Life and Tragic Death of King Farouk. Well, that's it for this week's look at the life, the anatomy, the struggles of the Playboy. Anatomy of a Lounge Lothario. Thanks for joining me.